Hi, this is Against Everyone with Connor Abib. Friends, I've been doing a few episodes on work, first about podcasting, then about content creation with bestselling author Caitlin Doughty. But when I talk about the work of my life, I mean, or at least I think I mean, my spiritual work. But then when I consider spiritual work, I have to say I'm not sure I know what spiritual work means. Only that it is somehow distinct from everything else I do and directed at what is deepest, what connects truth with love, with wisdom, with kindness, with righteousness. But is there something more to that than simply spiritual practice? I think that's what a lot of people mean when they say their spiritual work, meditating, contemplating, or if they're more ritualistically inclined, doing some kind of ritual, magic, that sort of thing. I also notice sometimes when I say my spiritual work is important to me, people will respond with things like, well, my spiritual work, my spirituality is walking on the beach, or my spiritual work is spending time with my family. But I know that this isn't exactly right. I obviously don't want to condemn the experience of spiritual presence and love that arises from that sort of thing, from those life experiences. I just know that's not exactly what is meant. But what is meant? And do we make enemies out of distinctions when we say, I want to do my spiritual work, but I'm so busy with all these other things? In other words, aren't they all spiritual? Or do we banish important distinctions by saying everything is spiritual? On top of all that, there's the anti-work stance that I take and I believe is correct and true and good, that work the way it exists now, particularly with the wage-labor relationship where we pay people for their time, is really an evil construct. It's one of the worst developments of society, a disease almost. To pay people for their work, to say that your time is worth this amount of money, I think that's terrible. So how do I think about spiritual work in that light when what a real kind of work would mean would be offering who we are, offering the efforts of what we truly see and encounter and being supported. And because of that awful form of work that we live with, we often feel that we don't have the time or clarity or space, even if it's just psychic space, to do our spiritual work. So I thought to consider this, I should talk with someone whose job is spiritual work, or religion in this case. Jonah Evans is a priest and a Lenker in the Christian Community, which is the religious renewal community developed by and inspired by Rudolf Steiner. He's also been on the show once before in episode 220 when we talked about why anyone would engage with esoteric Christianity in the first place and what it is. Together with Patrick Kennedy, who has also been on the show a few times, he co-hosts the podcast The Light in Everything, which is one of my very favorite podcasts and a beautiful exploration of spirit. This is a great episode exploring some very difficult things to pull apart when it comes to our spiritual lives and it comes to our work lives. This offering, this podcast, this work is a huge effort every week. I hope you love it, and if you feel connected to it, that you express some sense of connection through economic support to the show. Patreon.com/ConnorHabib is the place to do it. It's a pretty clean expression of care and connection because you're not paying me for my labor. You're not paying me for my time, even though I might talk about how much time and labor it takes to do the show sometimes. You're just saying, I feel connection and I want to express my sense of connection to the show. So you can do that through patreon.com/ConnorBeeb, and you get access to salons, events, spiritual thoughts and exercises I post sometimes, announcements, etc. All right, So, what is spiritual work? What do we mean by that anyway? Here's my conversation with Jonah Evans. Hello, everybody. This is Against Everyone with Connor Abib. Hello, Jonah Evans. Nice to see you again.
So good to see you, Connor.
Okay. So I have been doing a few episodes on work and what it means to be at work right now and some of the weird kinds of work that I do and what that entails and some of the spiritual aspects of it. But then I just thought, well, why am I not doing an episode on spiritual work, right? Which is, aside from my work life, the great work of my life, I suppose. And so I thought, who better to ask than someone who actually has as his job spiritual work, and then the other kinds of spiritual work that we all do to some degree or another, and then some that we don't all do. So only some of us do. Mm. So there are so many places to start with this. I think maybe I was debating whether or not to begin with, you know, what actually is the work you do in the Christian community, if we look at that as an occupation. But I think we should start there, because that's going to be the kind of work that other people don't do. That's going to set your job in a way, what we might call a job, although the pay structure is very different. Yeah. From most people's jobs, which maybe makes it not a job. I don't know. But that sets your day apart. What does that daily work life look like? Let's start there.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, and you mean just in a practical sense, you don't mean.
You can be totally as if I'm just looking from the outside at you. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, from a practical kind of normal view, the life of a priest, although, you know, my work is kind of a little more unique than a normal priest, because I also direct a seminary and I'm trying to now also care for the congregations in North America and care for the priests in North America. It's kind of like a archbishop, I guess you would call it. We call them Lenkers. It's a German word that means handlebar.
That's why you have that mustache. Yeah. Not quite ahead of our mustache, yeah.
Yours. Yeah, so a normal kind of just outside view of my daily work would be, you know, on Monday I try to take time for study and preparation. Tuesday, I'm just full in. Usually there's a class in the morning. Usually there's a consecration, a Eucharist service in the morning. Every priest is called to do meditation and prayer three times a day out of what we call our breviary. Then there's teaching usually throughout the day, teaching other people to become priests. And then sprinkled in there, I'm having meetings with people in need, people who need guidance. I'm often doing also throughout the week different podcasts with my colleague and others, and teaching a lot in the congregation, study groups. Most of my evenings are reserved for emergency meetings and board meetings. So we also have boards that carry the legal and financial reality of congregations. And then when it comes to Saturday, usually, I mean, as it works out for me, and every priest is slightly different in this regard, as it works out for me now, my Sabbath really begins on Friday evening. Kind of amazingly. And on Saturdays, I usually spend time with the family, unless there's an emergency. Cleaning, buying groceries, normal stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then Sunday, I'm at the congregation or a congregation in North America, giving a sermon or celebrating the Mass, having consultations afterward.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a kind of normal week.
Yeah, I mean, the first thing that strikes me is that, I mean, it's just something to consider, I suppose, is that a priest is someone who remains committed to God and Christ while working on the Sabbath, everyone else's Sabbath day. that there's this inverse quality to rest and work that's supposed to be a lot of, I mean, that's really interesting to me. I mean, do you know where in the, I guess it wouldn't be in the Bible, would it? That says, well, if you're a priest though, you're going to work on the Sabbath. You're going to work on the whole day.
Right. That's a bit of a conundrum for clergy. But there's two places that speak about the Sabbath and keeping the Sabbath. One is Deuteronomy. The other one escapes me at the moment. But that's certainly connected to the religious life of many Christians and, of course, many Jews. The traditional Sabbath is Saturday, Friday night into Saturday evening. And often for many Christians, they take a Sunday, but for priests and pastors, that is not necessarily a rest day.
Mm-hmm. And that, is that a sacrifice in a way? I mean, I'm wondering if that's part of the sacrifice of being, of doing religious work, which is that you'll feel not a part of everyone else in a way by virtue of that switch in time and switch in behavior. That actually there are lots of ways, of course, in which someone who is doing that work is removed or different in a way, but actually that I can see that very clearly as a sacrifice when it's like, well, yeah, but you're going to work on the holy day. When people actually come and create a world rhythm of rest, you're going to be at work for God.
Right. Yeah. In a way, from a certain perspective, that is a sacrifice. And like many vocations, a priest is never off, actually, so to speak. And yet, there's still, even in that light, there's still a way to connect to the depth of the Sabbath, which the Sabbath isn't just a day off. It, in a way, it's an archetypal picture of celebrating and valuing the peace that comes at the end of creation.
Mm.
So from another perspective, one can practice Sabbath at any moment as a way, or any day as a way to celebrate when the new creation finally comes to a culmination, which in the Christian tradition is pictured in the New Jerusalem, where deep peace and rest and communion with God is recognized, known, felt, and celebrated. So from that light, then even on a Sunday when I'm quote-unquote working, if the deep peace and seed hope of the New Jerusalem and its reality awaken in my heart and in others' hearts, then we're also celebrating the Sabbath.
So I just want to take this work week that you've described, just in the most material or physical terms. You know, one of the things that comes up a lot on this show, inspired in me long before I came to know anything about Rudolf Steiner, but he certainly takes it up, is the idea that, you know, work is like an abomination in a way when we're talking about paying people for their labor. But there are other ways in which it comes up. Just the whole wage labor relationship, of course, is terrible. And people besides Rudolf Steiner, obviously, have pointed that out. But also, you know, even if I'm thinking about spiritual development, spiritual truth, you know, I'm thinking, I think we talked about this last time, I'm thinking of Valentin Tonberg's idea of the magician, the concentration without effort is actually the skill and the aptitude which brings new spiritual, you know, acts and life into the world. Not that I would say effort and work are the same thing, but I'm just kind of thinking about that. I'm also thinking, so your work is paid for differently. So we should talk about that real quickly, because it actually is one of the few jobs that is, I think, sort of structured around the principles that Rudolf Steiner laid down. And that is related to, I mean, even, you know, biodynamic farms, anthroposophical branches, they all do the same wage labor relationship. Well, not all of them, but most of them, which is like really ridiculous. But, you know, if you have Rudolf Steiner saying no one should be paid for their labor, and that when you ask someone to be paid for their time, or you allow yourself to be paid for your time, something that is belongs to you inherently is is taken from you, but only in an illusion sort of way, but it is still nevertheless taken from you. You're convinced of the illusion and it's pulled away from you. Your work is not like that. So I think maybe we talk about the wage part first, and then we talk about what separates what you do from working for a living or working to make a living, because it's very different. And then, but not just yet, we can go to, you know, the idea of vocation, and what that means, and also ways that that's distorted now in like massive influencer culture vocation speak, you know?
Yeah. Okay. Beautiful. Well, practically first, the way the priesthood is set up, the priest circle is set up, is based on, first and foremost, the sending. So every priest, kind of like the military, I guess, if you're sent somewhere to be a soldier, every priest is sent by the leadership to a congregation that they don't choose, and the congregation doesn't choose them. So they're sent, hopefully, with the intention that there's an inspiration from the Holy Spirit that this priest is sent to a particular congregation, let's just say Toronto. And then the priest, every priest is considered to be full-time priest. So meaning they're always ready to do priestly work, which is basically teaching, counseling, and celebrating the sacrament.
I just want to make sure I don't miss this because we get too far away. How is that decided where someone will go? I mean, I'd be really interested in knowing that process, because I think it's just so mysterious from the outside, probably a bit mysterious on the inside in a way, but like, I don't want it to be mystified. I want to try to understand it a little bit before we keep going.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there is a deep mystical process that connects with the fact that the Father has sent Christ out. So we're just trying to imitate that first sending. But practically, now that I'm also a kind of ascender one that is in charge of sending priests to North American congregations, practically that has to do with a kind of interesting alchemy where you're in relationship with a congregation and its needs and its character and its qualities, And you're also in deep relationship with each priest in your region. And you're having a kind of living conversation between the two, noticing when there's a call. Oh, and it comes in like a picture, an imagination, an inspiration, a thought, a feeling that this particular priest's gifts could serve well this particular need in this particular group of people. And then you start, okay, could you imagine this? And then at some point you decide, this is the sending. And that also has to do with the central leadership, the Lenker, myself is in conversation with the central leadership, and they then bless it, and it happens.
Got it.
So, yeah. Right. So, but where, I forgot where we were.
Well, you were talking about just how the process of even being assigned the role worked, but then we're moving towards the economic or the financial, I should say, aspect of it.
Right. So in that sending, then hopefully there is a consciousness of practical needs. The idea is that the congregation would support the practical needs for that particular priest's life to have basic needs met. So a place to live, a car to drive, perhaps, hopefully, if that's needed. Maybe if you're in New York City, you don't need a car. And enough money every month to have food, clothing, and basic personal needs. So that kind of support package is completely disconnected from how big the congregation is, how much work the priest will do, all these things. Mm. The understanding is the needs are, we try to meet the basic needs of the life of the priest, but that's completely disconnected from how much work the priest will be called to do. For example, I'm now the Lenker and a seminary director and helping out in the congregation in Toronto. So I have huge amounts of work. In the normal world, you would think I would have a triple salary. But my salary remains exactly the same. I don't have a salary. My income remains exactly the same because my needs are exactly the same. Mm-hmm. I work as much more. Mm-hmm. So that's a kind of my attempt to describe this separation of financial support and work. Mm.
Yeah, it's funny because this might seem, well, you guys use Patreon too for your podcast, The Light and Everything. But I try to describe my Patreon as kind of close to that in a way, which I know it's not. I mean, obviously it's in some ways to even describe the two as the same is ridiculous, but I do try to say to people, look, this is one of the only ways I can think to get paid for this with, or to receive money for support without you paying me for my labor, that actually people are coming together to say, I appreciate who you be in the world, like your presence of being in the world. And maybe you put out one podcast a month, maybe you put one out every week. You know, I don't think it's that pure, that clear. I think that if I stop making podcasts for 2 months, people probably would drop off and be like, what are you doing? I'm giving you support every week. Now, listen, dear listener, I don't think that of most of you, but I'm just saying an anxiety that I have. but I think that that's something that I find inspiring about the Christian community. And I mean, it's just the one of the ideal anthroposophically or Christian ways to view how money can work is, well, you know, we appreciate your being and we want to support your being and presence here. And does it feel, I don't mean this as a challenge, I actually just mean this as a question for you. Like, does it feel one-sided sometimes in a way? You know, I mean, you're engaged with your community in a way that the economic sharing, the sort of dipping into it, I guess maybe it's just another way in which you might be separate, in which priesthood makes you separate from others in a way. And I don't mean that in a bad way, but can make you feel somehow alienated because you're removed not from the economic sphere, obviously. We're all in that together. But your position in it feels quite different than other people's position.
Oh yeah. There's many, in many ways in which that is a difficult challenge to be in. It's a blessing in many ways. It's very freeing, but it's also very challenging because unlike most people, you have a board or a group of people that are responsible to help support your needs. And you have to be very transparent about it. So you have to be very vulnerable about what you need and when. And then you're open also to attacks. Well, my family never needed that, or we don't, you know, why are you this? And so there's all kinds of projections often that then make revealing your needs and simply living off the gifts of others. So that's another thing. It calls for a tremendous trust building and bearing a kind of vulnerability to be in a situation where you're not earning any money. Mm. You're just being gifted money based on your saying, I need this. Mm. So it's a very strange to normal culture place to be in.
Mm-hmm. It's really beautiful when you say it as, I mean, that kind of vulnerability. It's just that we wish that everybody were able to receive their income in the same way. And I think that's why I think, you know, I know most people that work for the Christian community aren't like rolling in dough, right? There's a freedom there, but you know, I think when people hear some of this, they might be like, well, what is it? You know, like, didn't Jimmy Swagger just like pass around that box and get, you know, like millions of dollars? But it's not that kind of situation. And so it is, there is something really beautiful about saying, just for all of us to say, look, I have these needs and, you know, I have a place here as your neighbor. And I appreciate you being my neighbor as well. And how can we, you know, express our needs and our vulnerability and support each other? I think that's really lovely. It's something that I want to be available for everyone. And so in that way, there's a bit of leadership there too. In the same way that you were saying, well, we send people out to echo that first, you know, but you know, you just have to be careful when you say that because you don't want people hearing like I said, the Jimmy Swagger thing, like the evangelical thing of like, you know, give me that. But those people were manipulated very often into thinking that they were giving money for their salvation, which is completely different.
Exactly. So we in the Christian, if I ever heard a priest saying, you know, give us money because God is going to favor you more. absolute immediate no. Because the grace chalice can never be manipulated. Otherwise, it's just another form of earning.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, it is. That is funny. Isn't it? Because the inverse is like, you know, if you do a better job, eventually you'll get paid more, right?
Okay. So yeah. That is interesting. And this has to do with the inner, this whole relationship that we're describing also has to do with a real developmental process in any soul, including priests.
Mm.
Because we have deep, deep expectations and shadows in our being that have to come out and be transformed if we're really going to practice this kind of, I mean, it's really living by the grace of God.
Mm.
And that's not just because you would like to live by the grace of God doesn't mean that you're immediately able to do it.
Mm.
So there's actually an initiation process for every priest who picks up this way of living. And there's trials connected to it. I can remember one of my trials. It was one of the most significant experiences of my life in connection to learning to live in surrendered grace.
Are you going to tell me about that a little bit?
Yeah. I'd love to. Yeah. So I was 2 years into priesthood. I was a rookie and I was in Spring Valley, which is near New York City, sent there. And we came to a point where we had no money in our bank account. Zero. And I had a newborn child. And I was feeling the anxiety. Oh my gosh, what's going to happen? And I then took up with help from my board. Okay, I'm going to make this letter and we're going to write out how you should give and what, you know, if you make this amount, you have to give this much a month and this amount, you have to give this much a month and da 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 da. And I sent it out and it was a total, nobody responded. And I started to think, and this had been increasingly, although I was unaware, I was increasingly irritated and angry with my congregation, deep in my soul. Although nobody would know that I knew that or that I was that. It was just kind of this feeling of irritation. You're not doing what you should be doing. I give you sermons and teaching. You have to give me money so that I can live. And that was, unbeknownst to me, still my dynamic that was making me angry. So I was still locked into this kind of, I give you something, you give me something, and you're not doing your part. So damn it, do it. And long story short, working through this rising anger, I remember I was walking around this beautiful park. I was trying to process what's going on here. And I realized that underneath my anger was a deep fear of, I am not being a good priest and therefore no one's giving money.
Mm.
I had connected my value of a priest as if I'm good, then people will give me money.
Mm-hmm.
And I was scared of losing what I loved, which was to be a priest. And as soon as this fear kind of arose in me, I then kind of realized that I was locked in this fear. And I prayed, Lord, help me to find right relationship to this fear of not being able to be a priest, not being a good priest, right relationship to how to work with money rightly. And after a few moments of emptiness and walking and hoping, a strong imagination came into my heart and mind. And it was of the sun, just the normal sun that we all know. And the sun radiates its light and warmth to all, whether good or bad, raining or shining. It's constantly giving itself. And it's not expecting anything from the earth, from the plants, from anything, from humans, animals. It just gives. And in that moment, for me, it was a revelation. I would I would say from the Holy Spirit. And I realized that I had been working in the prison of and the assumption of I do this and you do that. And my joy was being crushed. Mm-hmm. So my final realization was I'm going to give whatever, I'm just going to give what I love, sermons, celebrating, counseling, and I'll do whatever it takes then, if I have to get a job at McDonald's or Starbucks, to support the finances. But nothing is going to stop me from giving what I love, which is the work of the priest. That liberated my heart. And then I went back and wrote a letter and I said, give what you can. We will move through this. And at the end of that year, and that's not to be considered a classical New Age manifestation, but at the end of that year, we had a $20,000 surplus.
Well, oh gosh, there's so much to say right now. I hope I can say that in the right order. Right. I'm not a priest, but I work in the cultural sphere. So we share the sphere in which we work because people doing, you know, that kind of work, religious work, are also working in the realm of artists, the realm of philosophers, or maybe not ethical philosophers, but philosophers and whatever. People are doing cultural work. You know, it's almost like ashamed to say it, but I feel that resentment all the time. And it's not about anything. Like, if I stand back and look at it, like, if I really look at it, I'm like, first of all, it's a little different because I'm not mad at the people that are contributing money, right? And even if someone's contributing money and they stop, I just always feel great gratitude for them. But I'm like, why not more people, right? And when I look at... I'm just saying the thought process out loud because it's completely ridiculous, but it's not felt as ridiculous when I'm going through it. Well, you know, my podcast is in like the top 1% of podcasts, like worldwide. Like when it does well, it's like up there. Now that doesn't really mean that much actually, because most podcasts only have like 30 listens per episode. So being in the top 1% is not that hard. Being in the difference between my podcast and, you know, like Joe Rogan, which is number one, is like, you know, millions and millions and millions of listens. But anyway, okay. So it's up there and I know I'm doing this substantive thing. I'm having these real conversations. I know it's changing people's directions of thought. It's inspiring new thoughts. It's inspiring conversations. And I have this book out and I know the book's pretty good. I feel good about it. It's was, you know, nominated for this major award, blah, blah. Why the fuck are more people not paying me money for what I am doing because it's good? Now, the difference between you and me in this is that I'm probably way more egotistical because I'm not like I'm doing bad. I'm like the world is bad and likes shit and therefore will not support someone doing good work, right? So that creates some differences in the way that we approach. So I'm blaming everyone. You had the good sense to blame yourself, which was still wrong, but at least you, yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
But at first I was blaming them.
Okay. So maybe I will eventually reach the higher stage of self-loathing. So I get into this resentment thing and like you, I'm revealing it now on the show, but I mostly conceal it. But you know, people feel something, whether you conceal it or not. They might not even, it might not be a feeling, but like the people can get it. Like they'll encounter, experience something in you, and maybe they won't be able to name it or articulate it, but they'll get it.
which always, by the way, blocks you from getting what it is that you hope, right? So I then, like, what I'll think is like, well, I'm not going to do anything else with my life. I'm not going to work at McDonald's, not because I think that's, well, I mean, their politics as a company are bad, but not that because I think working in that is bad. I mean, I've worked retail jobs for a good chunk of my life, but I'm not able to do that work anymore. I just feel completely removed from that realm. So I'll just be completely poor and just like poverty. That's what will come. And I will, yes, continue in some way to do what I do. But then, you know, I look at that and I'm like, well, who turns that way? Like, what would this actually lead to? It's something that you and I talked about the last time I think you were on the show, which is the kind of angry street preacher who is talking about the sins of the world and the cruelty in the world and, you know, proclaiming it while pretending to hold a kind of virtue. It's coming, some of the message is real. There is something beautiful and pure about actually the courage to stand and do, even though you have a open, empty suitcase in front of you that people are throwing some money into. There is some courage there, but it's coming through in this distorted way because your view of what's happening and the relationship you have with the all through the economic realm and through the political realm is complete, and to others through the political realm is completely distorted. So that's actually where my path would end up if I'm not careful in like regulating it is like, and you see this actually, there's a lot of kind of angry influencer podcast, spiritual podcaster, you know, small indie church leader kind of people that go this way and they hold that resentment and it becomes the picture they get out of it is the sins of the world. And I have to be very careful about that. And so I try to do what you said, which is like, just be in what, but I have to admit it does still cloud my vision. It doesn't really take the form of resentment so much anymore, but it takes the form of resignation. Like I'll be like, well, if nobody pays attention, then nobody pays attention, which I'm not really that, I don't think that's right either. I mean, it's definitely better than resentment, but I don't think it's actually the right mood either for what I'm trying to go through.
Yeah. Yeah. I can totally relate too. And by no means, just because I kind of passed that trial that I described, or I was blessed by that grace that occurred, by no means is the wrestling finished. There is part of my beastly dragon self that is constantly irritated that I'm not more glorified by money and results and whatever. And over the years, I've begun to be familiar with that beast in me and know, but I do know that focusing, making my primary focus the love and joy I have in the task that I'm called to do, making that the key and practicing again and again, letting go of all results, that has kept my heart connected to joy more than anything. And joy, real joy, surrendered joy for the work. That is the most important thing. And the most, actually, in this realm, the most potent weapon against the darkness.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think we're going down a different pathway before, but I want to take it in the direction of what we're talking about right now, because something I think about a lot is the ways in which I long for a life in which I just attend to the things that matter to me spiritually. However, even that desire, there's a bit of a lie in it, right? So if I look at my, time now, it's not like I'm so busy there are times in my life when I'm really, really busy, But then there are times that I'm not. And it's not that I'm so busy every day that I don't have time to contemplate, to meditate, to turn the greater part of my attention toward the spiritual world each day. And I know it's always with me each day. I never lose it, which is one thing that I think is very, I'm very blessed by that. It never goes. But if I look at my life now, like today, I knew I was going to do this. I knew I was going to write. And I knew there were a few other things I should do for my work life. And in between, you know, there's this choice. It's like, do I read this novel by Ian Banks or do I read this book by Peter Dunov about the apocalypse? You can bet I read the novel, right? And I do need rest, obviously. I understand that. But there are plenty of days when I'm not as busy as today, when I still don't do the spiritual effort. So there's a just to sort this out, there's a fantasy that if I were economically fully supported, that I would devote my life to spiritual work, which is not true. And again, these are all in some ways artificial divisions. I understand reading the novel is spiritual, doing, you know, sending the email is spiritual, but come on, like we also know that there's a difference. So I want to just like say that there's also a difference. And so there's a fantasy there, but then also there's a truth there to it as well. I mean, so it's very hard to sort through those things. There is a truth that I probably would devote more time to this life if things were provided for in a certain way. And there is also a lie there. But it's really difficult to sort through which is which. Maybe in some ways you're the least qualified person to answer this because your work is directed towards spiritual work. But I don't know. Maybe you want to reflect on that with me.
Well, in that way, I am the least qualified probably. But in another way, that particular conundrum archetypally, I don't think anyone is ever free of it in a way in the wrestling because it's the human spirit is always, always saying, if this were the case, if I had that house, if I had that job, if things were as they should be, then I could be fully fulfilled. And that's actually deeply, deeply inlaid as a truth in the human spirit. Because if I work with the pictures of the Christian tradition, we're actually moving toward a place and a time and a reality that is the fulfillment of what should be. And I will then, in that great hope, feel fully fulfilled. So there's actually a deep core truth there. However, it gets twisted and shadowed in all of us when we hope, oh, if I just had that much money, then I could do what and I could be what I wanted.
Yeah. You know, because I was going to ask you, why is there such an antagonism between the sort of outpicturing the worldly version of the economic realm and our spiritual lives? But, you know, it makes sense to me that, you know, the physical, the material, and then its illusory physical nature, they're what compose us in our incarnation. And that substance is the remnant, not the remnant, it is the product of a spiritual battle against God that has fallen. And so the clothing that we wear, our spiritual selves, the clothing that we wear as the material that composes us, and therefore the material life and all the material goods we want and the things that we want is made out of the battle against God. And that to me is like, oh, well, no wonder there's this constant antagonism. And so the work is a work of constant redemption. And so that's part of what
beautiful.
part of what you're saying when you're like, well, I just try to pay attention to what I love. It's not the new age thing of do what you love and the money will follow. It's I redeem the doing with love.
Yeah. That's it. I love how you describe that distinction. I want to emphasize it because it's not like I'm now trying to make everything as I would like it. What I'm now trying to do is feel blessed and try to love whatever arises. And receive as gift whatever is given. So that doesn't mean that it will make everything good. That means that it will be a challenge when I have those difficult board meetings to see that and enter that as something that is meant for me to work with and meant to redeem, as you just said. It's constantly redemptive work. So I love my friend. I saw him there in Dublin when I was just before we went to dinner. My friend Kim Schneider, who runs a company, he said, I'm always hoping that things with my problems will get less and less. But actually, the reality is my problems get more and more complex and varied. And so the work is then saying, okay, actually, life is about seeing through the challenges at any moment to see what I can love and what I can receive as grace in and through the darkness.
Yeah, including the fact that I want to just maybe clarify something I said by taking up what you've said, that when I say that the material world is composed of a sort of substance that comes from a battle against God, I'm not claiming that that material is evil so much as it needs to be loved in a different way, just to say what in the way you've said, like that I need to apply love in a different way. That I need to do love in a way that is different than some of the other kinds of love that I'm doing, you know? Yeah.
And so there may be distortions that arise from being in the material bodies, illusions, as we've talked about, egotisms and self-interest, but those are not to be condemned.
Right.
And that's the great allergic reaction that actually I think every deep human heart has against anything institutionally religious.
Right. Yeah. It's a
condemnational spirit. But actually, the picture is to work against the condemnational spirit, because there's no condemnation in Christ, actually. Mm-hmm. And to try to find where is the gift and how can I love, no matter how dark it gets, because that's the source of deep joy in the human heart. And joy is what sustains us, actually. It's not the voice in us that says what should be that sustains us. It's the voice in us and the heart in us that says, I'm going to redeem what is.
Yeah, it's really important. This thing you say, it's like actually what we're meant to do is to move against that or dissolve that condemnational urge. The way I've been thinking about this lately is, you know, there's this like this seeming contradiction that people wrestle with when it comes to religion or spiritual impulse. Like, well, if everything is love, then why do we, you know, what does any of it matter, you know, or it's all perfect or whatever. That is all true. And that includes the condemnation. So when you look at a religion or a group of or a church that's saying, condemn these people, they're sinners, and they think that they're expressing love, it's actually true, which is, let me finish this statement before you jump on me. It's actually true that they are expressing love. But that's only because everything is love. There is such a difference in doing love, in working with the forces of love, working with the substance of love. So that's us bringing our freedom, bringing our being to bringing love forward and working with it. So we're not just in some ways, I would maybe call it laziness. Maybe that sounds too condemnational, but we all understand laziness and we all enjoy it. So I'm just going to maybe leave it at that. It's like there's a laziness in saying this is God's love to condemn, because actually that reveals the truth to people. But if we work against condemnation, we can feel that there is an effort there, and that's us working with love. And that's just a massive difference. And I would say also, even the people, when we're talking about material goods and economy and everything, the things that come to us that we want. I want this. I don't know why SUV is always the thing that people talk about when I want that like SUV or whatever, or I want this giant house or I want whatever. Fine. Like in some ways, that is all God's will and that is all love. But are you really working with love to understand what you want, which is very different, you know? So how do we work with the forces of love? And that's actually adding a capacity to the world when we do that.
Okay. Well, I love that. I mean, in a certain way, I can understand what the distinction you're making there with where everything is love and yet there's condemnation practiced by some people, but that actually they're trying to love. That's what I think.
Yeah.
And I think that's true, because deep in that impulse is to uphold the truth of the divine. And that comes out of a love for God usually. However, it can get distorted in as much as we're not aware of the egotisms and falsities that are clouding our vision. So I often call it right impulse, wrong address.
Right.
Meaning, yeah. It's like in my experience, I had the right impulse to work with money, to work with the right relationship between priest and congregation. But my vision was clouded with egotism and self-interest. And what it did, the fruit of that was it made me more and more angry at the world, less and less able to love and sacrifice. So I also wouldn't want to say there are also forces in reality that I'm called to struggle with that cloud my heart's capacity to love. And that's the human condition also, to wrestle with those things that cloud our sight and tempt us to focus on. It's described very simply in the Sermon on the Mount: focus first on the kingdom of God at hand, not on outer results, materialism, even though all of that has to be attended to. Focus first on love, hope, faith, long-suffering, compassion. And then everything else will fall into place.
Right. Yeah. And there are forces that cloud it. And then there is a force which is trying to undo it. And that's beyond clouding. It's actually trying to undo its own substance, which is very strange, because even that is made of love in its own way, but it's trying to undo the love.
That's it. It's trying to, or maybe even like you said, the word you used, redeem. So this is a deeply interesting mystery, because without the betrayer, for example, without the the adversarial force, the costly love of self-offering can't be revealed. Mm-hmm. So if everything were just easy, mm-hmm. we wouldn't actually be able to reveal the redemptive love and give ourselves in the sacrificial way that's called for. It would just be easy and it wouldn't actually be love. Mm-hmm. We all know, like, stories, novels, you know, movies where there's a character that has, through incredible adversity and sacrifice, kind of triumphs with love, like Martin Luther King Jr., for example. Mm-hmm. Sacrificial love rises out of the forces that would want to cloud it. Mm-hmm. But there's a symbiotic necessity for those two to be there.
Mm. Which is your challenge when you're resenting and then also resenting yourself, was to walk in one way, walk against the current, and in one way, walk with it. But it felt like walking against the current, you know, as you were trying to achieve and do and come to the place where you could get past that. You know, it probably felt like walking in really heavy water until you realized that actually you were being assisted also in the direction you were going. Yeah. Mm.
If the river of resentment is very strong and big.
That's a hard current. That's a really hard one. Because that's the one where you realize you've been swept really far down the river. You know, there are other currents that they also just suck and they're hard. But the resentment one is the one where you've been in the river for a really long time, you know, and you don't even realize that you need to go in the other direction until you're very far down, downstream. And you've got a ways to go back. I want to think about. Okay. Work again. I just want to bring it back to spiritual work. I don't even like the word for it in a way, just because of what work is to us now, to most of us now. Sometimes I say effort, you know, even when I send out podcast invitations, I'm like, I'm a great admirer of your efforts, but then I think that that sounds like they failed, you know, in what they're trying to do. Cause I just don't like saying, I love your work.
I get it. Yeah. You've tried hard, but maybe someday you'll succeed.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Great try. I'm a great admirer of everything you've tried. but anyway, spiritual work, maybe we'll come to a better term by the end of this podcast. I don't know, but there are so many forms of it. I think people tend to think of spiritual work as spiritual practice, but I don't think that those are necessarily the same thing. Practice is something that you do, but it can take a lot of effort. It can be work, but that's so much different than when a spiritual task or challenge arises in my life and I have to confront it. And a lot of times the practice doesn't seem like it's even helped me. It probably has, but a lot of times those will just take a completely different kind of action, a different kind of feeling, and a different kind of approaching in my thinking than the practice. So maybe we can talk about how those are different, the certain kinds of spiritual work versus spiritual practice. Because everybody, I do think, if I see spiritual work, they'll just think practice.
Yeah, that's very true. Spiritual work often means meditation, spiritual exercises, prayer, or something of that. And a spiritual orientation to work maybe would describe a little more about, like, how do you approach your own outer work spiritually?
I just want to add something before you take it away. Before you take it away with the mic. Yeah. I also mean, you know, sometimes I'm sure you've experienced this. You receive a spiritual instruction. It might be weird. You might not completely understand it, but you decide to, you know, you do it because it's given. And that's a different kind of spiritual work that it's not even rhythmic. Like, it doesn't even have the pattern to it, other than just to, you know, maybe there's a pattern that you've developed in your life to just say yes to what God asks. But I wanted to add that piece to it.
Yeah,
when
that's, work. Yeah, that's very, and that really describes often what comes to us in our lives. And I think the root here, at least where my heart and mind go to in terms of the root challenge here, is really, how does the human heart, how does the human soul live in relationship to effort, what I do out of myself, and grace, what has gifted me from the Spirit into my life, into my heart at random moments, maybe seemingly random moments. The Spirit moves where it wills. So when we talk about this, and that's an interesting thing that you brought up at the very beginning, this Meditations on the Tarot book, where the first arcanum is the magician. And it talks about this, how to be in right relationship with spirituality and work so that it's effortless, so that it's flowing in a harmony. And that touches in on this mystery. Well, what does my action, how does my action rightly meet and work with the action of God, the gifting of the Spirit? And I like to look at any effort that I do, whether or not it's meditation or prayer or preparing for a sacrament, praying in a sacrament, or trying to work with my own dragon, like I described, the effort that it takes for me to try to transform myself. All of those things would be the part of spiritual work that I would have to attribute to myself. I have to do something. I have to create a pattern. I meditate 3 times a day. I do the sacrament once, twice a week. But there's also this other incredible stream that has to do with grace, that has to do with what comes to me from God, that says, at any moment, you may be called, you may be brought a crisis, you may be brought a spiritual gift that enlightens your heart, that you're called to either receive or not. And the interaction between those two, what I decide to do and how I decide to take up whatever it is, and learning to receive the gift from the Spirit. That's also a tremendous part of the work. Mm-hmm. I remember a dear friend of mine in the congregation just before he died of cancer. He had this profoundly transformative moment, and he realized he had not been receiving the love of his family. 2 days before he died, after the sacrament of the last anointing, he was broken open and realized, I have been shutting myself off from the love that my family has for me. And also the love that now I feel from God. And so he realized in that moment that it is also a tremendous part of the work of a human spirit, effort of a human spirit, to learn to be open to the blessings that are streaming in. That's not just a given. The given is that they're coming, but can I receive them? Can I take them up? Can I be blessed?
What a beautiful way to, I've not really thought about it before. Like, I think a lot about how I can, people can receive the love from others, but they're not in touch with the comforter, that they're not, that they'll receive the comfort from the people in their lives, but that they don't understand that that comfort that comes through those people is coming through the comforter. But this is the reverse, which is so interesting. And I bet a lot of us feel that way, and we don't acknowledge it, that I can feel the love of God, sure, as I relate to God. But when I try to relate to it through others, that's where I block God's offering. That's where I block the move. And so that's very striking to me, because I think I probably don't allow, and it also goes into the resentment again. It's like, why are these people not supporting? Well, they are. God's here with me. God's coming through the words of my mouth. You know, like, why are these people not seeing that? And it's like, well, that's actually where I've decided to, you know, amputate the anatomy, amputate the limb of God, the hand of God, and not let it touch me. Yeah. So, yeah, I'm thinking still about this practice. Like, I'm thinking about people, including myself sometimes, who, you know, you fall out of practice, or you're not meditating, or, I mean, first of all, the way you meditate and pray and contemplate will change over time. So it's not even fair to expect the rhythm to be continuous and to appear in the same way across your lifetime, but you can fall out of it too, where you're just kind of not doing it. Now, there are some people that don't really do it at all, and yet their readiness is always present. And so in that way, you can identify that the spirit is always close. They're always close with the spirit, you know, in a way. So when something terrible happens, or someone needs help, or even when they're just having a conversation about something deep, and suddenly this wisdom fluoresces out of a person that's just like usually just listening to the dumbest pop music. And you know what I mean? You're like, where is this coming from? That kind of thing. I love dumb pop music too. So
yeah, me too.
But I'm wondering how necessary practice is in some ways as a component of spiritual work, when I understand it cannot be uniform. Like, it can't be prescribed. This is actually something that I think that, like, I wonder, I see in the Catholic Church for sure, prescribing certain forms, and certain forms of Protestantism prescribing certain forms of practice, and quantifying the amount of practice you have to do for certain absolution, you know, say 10 Hail Marys or whatever it is. But there still does seem to be in anthroposophy and elsewhere this idea that there is a certain amount or a certain way of practicing that must be adhered to. And I at once know that that's not true, and also know that I don't want to let myself or anyone else off the hook. So I want to balance that and think about how to make that not work, not meaningless work in practice, you know?
Yeah. Well, that's such an interesting mystery, and very, very important. And constantly we're struggling with that, because the human soul and the human heart is at the same time deeply knowing that its fulfillment is in to be in divine harmony with the love of God, and that is always being gifted. Actually, that's always available. Christ, the Lord God, is constantly giving us his being. However, we also know, or at least I hope we know, I certainly know, that I am constantly being burdened by forces in me that would blind me to that, that would blind me and distort my own glory for being a receiver of God's love. my own image of myself is mostly, my own pride is what I find mostly hinders me from that divine reciprocal relationship of love. And so what I would say the human heart and the human spirit then is challenged with is to not so much say, look, that's the solution. I just have to know that God is love, but be willing to enter into this wrestling match, divine wrestling match, constantly knowing that that's how it is. I'm meant to see and know and let go of, constant die to the part of me that's not able to be in relationship with grace.
Mm-hmm.
And also constantly try to find and redeem, I love that word that you used, mm-hmm. redeem my relationship with others and the world as I walk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm thinking about the times in life when really it seems like the only spiritual practice that might be available to a person is just endurance. Like, it could be because of a tragedy or deep depression that makes certain actions feel unavailable. So it's the spiritual practice is reduced to something as simple as I wake up, I live, I go to sleep. It becomes so, so hard. But then as someone begins to crawl out of that or emerge from that, then they have to, the next practice beyond endurance is a kind of is just honesty. Can I actually offer more than waking, living, and sleeping today? Is it in me? And honesty is, I'm orienting wisdom to truth. I'm able to orient my wisdom to what is true. And so the task after endurance is an honesty. And then there's a task after that. But I don't want to schematize it too much, but that's simple. Yeah.
I love it because it also rings to what the Apostle Paul says in the very challenging book, Letter to the Romans. And this, I think, is very important. Maybe something about what you're touching on is as soon as I have a task. So one of the problems with spiritual work is, okay, meditate 3 times a day, pray, and then you'll be good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, practice these 6 exercises, then you'll be good. Paul says in his letter, when I really awaken to the law, which is 614 whatever, and 10 commandments and all these different things that I have to do, when I really awaken to it, what I discover, he says, is that I'm a sinner. Because I can't now, I know that's a loaded word. But what I mean is, what I discover is I can't fulfill what I set my mind to fulfill.
Mm.
So I'm constantly not fulfilling what I think I should fulfill. But the only way I discover that honesty in me, that real kind of brokenness in me, is if I have an ideal that I set for myself and I don't make it.
Right. So well, like that's, yeah.
Like in anthroposophy, we have these 6 basic exercises and everyone fails at those.
Speak for yourself. No.
But that's actually meant to be, because we are meant to awaken to the fact that we can't actually fully attain the ideals that we set for ourselves.
Mm.
That's a good thing. Why? Because then I will be in that way protected from ever achieving my own glory by being perfect in the ideals that I set out for myself. Meaning, I will have to at some point in my efforts to do the good thing, fall to my knees, open my heart to something greater than myself.
Mm-hmm.
then I can start to, as long as I don't condemn myself and get too into self-pity and self-flagellating, then I can start to work with this symbiotic relationship of effort and grace. Effort and grace. And then this magical working without effort, this magical symbioticness can start to slowly appear. Jesus says it like, bring your burdens to me, for my yoke is easy, my burden is light. That's the kind of mood, because he's constantly also receiving grace from the Father. But we can't do that unless we see, oh, the ideals I set for myself, I actually can't quite muster.
It's such a good picture of who we are as individuals. I mean, one of the things that I think people get so confused about when they're doing spiritual practice is, well, you do this and then you do this and then you do this. But there are people always asking me, like, what should I read? What kind of meditation should I do? You know? And I'm like, well, I don't, you know, unless I've known that person for a long time, or I'm really sitting with them and looking at the course of their life, I'm like, I don't know. I mean, here's like five things that you could try, you know, but when you do and fail, you know, failure is an exploration of the dark contours of your individuality. So you learn about the positive version of yourself as well. Well, here's where I succeeded. Well, that was so easy. Why was this part so hard? Why am I so bad at, you know, being kind to people, but I'm so good at being kind to animals? That's like an easy. Yeah.
Right. It helps you get into a self-knowledge process.
Right. Yeah. And so you learn about this incarnation, this version of yourself. And then I was also thinking about your description. It's like, you know, I can see when I wake up and I have that intention to do this and that, or actually before I go to bed the night before, this is like a thing that Gurdjieff points out. He's like, you go to bed and you think you're going to do all this the next day, and then you wake up and that man is gone, you know? So you go to bed, you think you're going to do all this stuff. You wake up and you don't achieve all those things. And that's actually, you know, by the time you go to bed. And that's a picture of how a lifetime can go for you if you want, because waking and then doing your day and then going to sleep is a picture of being born, living, and dying. It's a miniature version of that. And so you can see, and that can also give you real forgiveness for others. That can actually also provide you with a different way to look at people's lifetimes, you know, because that's sometimes how someone's, including your own lifetime, probably will go. You know, I understand that word sin, you know, the common way of describing to miss the mark is, you know, what sin means. But I do understand why that's sin, because it's us not being who we had faith in we could be, you know. We don't live up to the faith.
And we constantly then struggle to find fulfillment as we place the ideal before ourselves again and again and again. Mm-hmm. So our relationship to that dynamic, if I'm feeling overly self-condemnating, when I don't achieve what I set out to achieve, then I can start to fall into depression. It becomes a very difficult process. But if I relate it, as you mentioned, if my failings can be doorways to experiencing forgiveness and the encouragement to try again, then it can be helpful. And that's why I think I think it's chapter one or maybe chapter two. I can't remember, in Rudolf Steiner's book, How to Know Higher Worlds. He gives a beautiful sentence there in relationship to this whole theme. And he says, if I'm experiencing impatience in myself, because I want to be and have right now what I think I should be and have in the life also of my meditation. If I'm experiencing impatience, he said, try to shift your heart and mind to a particular thought. And this particular thought is helpful as opposed to just being impatient. And that thought is, I'm going to do everything I can, constantly, constantly, again and again, no matter how many times I fail. And I'm going to wait patiently until the divine world, till God decides to bestow what I hope for into my heart.
Mm.
So it's a double activity, a double spiritual activity, to do everything you can again and again and again, and wait until what I hope for is gifted, blessed, brought to me, raided into, so that I don't fall into the danger necessarily of thinking it's my accomplishment. But my work is to prepare the chalice of my heart to receive the gift of God. And then I don't feel proud if it ever comes about. I feel gratitude.
I really, really love that. You know, something I've said before on the show, and that I understand, but I struggle to articulate it to others, is, you know, this, the esoteric lesson that everything bad that happens to you comes from you, and everything good comes from God, which is the exact opposite of what we're told to believe in now. And I understand why it's the opposite of why we're told to believe in now, because we're finally awakening to unmask like the problem with the structures that we live with in some ways the exhibits of the powers and principalities. I have trouble articulating why this is so sometimes. However, I think that you gave the positive version of it so beautifully. Like, actually, when we fail with a sense of equanimity, when we don't condemn ourselves in our failure, nor do we give up in our striving, then when we receive, we feel gratitude. And we know it's not just from us. I think that that's really a beautiful way of explaining something that people would have trouble maybe taking on board if it was expressed in the way that I just said it. Well, speaking of which, I mean, and maybe this is the last point we'll go into in this episode. So I just want to think about the spiritual work that people feel called to do and then need to do, and they know in their hearts that they want to do it. But they don't have your job, right? Or your whatever it is you call what you do. They don't have your vocation or whatever. Their everyday lives are crowded. And it's not just about time. It's about being able to find direction, being able to find a path that's real. What I mean by that is, a lot of people will just find some sort of prescriptive magical practice when they want to do, you know, their spiritual practice. They're like, well, this book said just do these spells or incantations or whatever, or I could buy this workshop or whatever. Those are easy points of access to clearing up the spiritual work that is finding the path in the first place, rather than just accepting one that's handed to you. And then there's, you know, obviously just the feeling of I'm exhausted. I'm too exhausted to engage with something that is spiritual work, you know, extra work. I'd like to talk about how to cultivate that a bit, because that's, and I'm sure you do that with a lot of people who, you know, are in your congregation, but those people are already oriented. So many people are not even oriented. Well, many people aren't even oriented to, you know, any sort of spiritual structure, system, person, you know, whatever. And they're just trying to, but they know that they know. I won't take it from the point of someone who hasn't even awoken to, I have a spiritual life that I want to explore. I mean, I think everybody does, but for some people that light is so dim that that's a different kind of work. Let's just take it from that base level of people have that spiritual longing, but there's no orientation. There doesn't seem to be any structure that suits. I think that's so many people. Mm-hmm. And to think about doing extra work just seems so utterly exhausting. So then they'll say things like, well, you know, my spiritual life is walking on the beach or hanging out with my daughter or whatever. All true. But again, that's not doing in the same way where you're working with the forces. So what's to be done there?
Well, such a good question. I love the universality of it. My heart would respond in this way at first, just to say, look, I think no matter who you are on the face of the earth, your heart is designed to have a longing to be fulfilled. Every single heart longs to find its fullest nature, fullest, most fulfilled reality. And I would say that deep impulse that actually lives in every human being to become fully human, I would call it, is being tempted right now in most of us to think that my fulfillment will come if I get everything that I want and makes me comfortable, it makes me happy. And that actually is, I would say, one of the biggest dangers to this deep, deep impulse coming to fulfillment. Mm. That actually the human heart isn't fulfilled. And this is interesting. Like, we all know this, if we've ever had a Christmas or a moment where we've had a lot of money and we've actually gotten everything we want for a moment and realize the next day, I'm not fulfilled. that actually the human heart finds its deepest tract of fulfillment, its deepest journey, when it goes through things like, and I'm not saying like referring to me, but through things like discovering how it was imprisoned in its own resentment, dying to that old self and finding new rejuvenating life so that one can love and give in a freer, more joyful way. That life, and that's available to every single human, no matter who you are or what you believe. That life is being called to us, coming to us in our lives. So if I find my religion with my daughter on the beach, or I find my religion in nature, or I find my religion wherever, that call is going to come to all of us. Can you meet the shadows in your being that are clouding your ability to love and joy, and learn to recognize them, die to them, and be renewed in something that feels like a gift that enables you to offer yourself in love and joy to other human beings in your life more? Mm-hmm. That is the place where the human heart becomes more and more fulfilled. And that's not dependent on doctrine. It is dependent on orientation and new eyes and new ears. But that can happen in the course of any life. Mm-hmm. If we're willing to meet ourselves, meet the shadows in our being, take responsibility, and at the same time open to the grace of the Spirit that wants to help us become new.
Yeah. The call is the form of the practice. So the shape, the experience of the call, like I'm with this person that I love. Now I experience that as a call to love. I experience love. So I experience the call to love rather than just saying, well, can I love everybody like I love this person in my life? Okay, that would be great too. That's mostly what like a Protestant community-based church would ask you to do in some way through action. Let's have a potluck for the people in the community. Let's share our love with everybody. But to go, to go past that and to say, where does this love come from? How does this love arise in me? What is the experience of this love? Who am I when I stand in this love? What am I as this love emerges? And make that my practice. That the form. That is what I understand you to be saying. And I love that. And I think the other way that people would take what you're saying is like, you know, there's this basic psychoanalytic principle. Well, when you get what you want, you don't want it anymore because what you want is to want. Now, I think that's very useful at revealing or lifting a certain veil. And I think everybody can benefit from good psychoanalysis as long as it doesn't drive them deeper into their problems, which, right. You know, psychoanalysis just does this like little judo move or where it's like, well, see, so actually, you know, that lack is a constitutive part of being. There's a nothingness, a void at the heart of everything. And we just have to learn to live with it. But that is one level. That's one level of understanding. It's good to get there, but it's not good to stop there in worship, right? And to worship the lack or worship the void.
Right? The void is for the fulfilled activity of the heart. The void is only there to be touched, not to stay in it.
Right.
But that it starts to form your chalice to receive the gift of grace. Mm-hmm. The void is meant to be touched constantly, mm-hmm. as a schooling of being more and more receptive to the gift from the Spirit. And that's where the human heart, when the human heart feels, I've been blessed. Mm. I've been gifted this new way of seeing. Whether it's with my children, where I've discovered a shadow in me that I have to let go and then open up to something new and then feel like, oh my gosh, that was a gift that I can love my children in a new way, or whatever. Mm. That inner dynamic is where the fountain of fulfillment is touched. And it's a living process. It can't be possessed. Mm. It has to be lived.
Yeah, well, that's it. I mean, that's why it's so hard, you know, when I argue, whenever I bring up psychoanalysis in that way, I have certain friends in mind. And a lot of psychoanalysts are very interested in Christianity because they think it actually is a form of expressing that lack. But when I think about, I'm not going to describe it here because one, I have trouble understanding it myself, except when I engage with the exercise, but Rudolf Steiner has this concave convex exercise. And I kind of view it as that. It's like when a psychoanalyst is talking about the lack or the split subject or the kind of separation, I can view it in this Christian esoteric sense of, well, if I just actually walk into that nothingness, if I understand that nothingness deeply enough, I actually find that the contours of that nothingness become the chalice that is in me to receive. Yeah.
That is it.
Yeah.
That's why we, for example, practice Passiontide in the Christian tradition. It's not to just be sad. Not just to be like depressed. Oh, it's to walk into the nothingness of the void of the abyss, which is actually the threshold. In order to form the chalice of the heart that can receive the grace of God that comes at Easter. Mm-hmm. That's the human heart longs to be actively in relationship with blessing.
Right.
And you cannot manipulate or force that. You can only prepare for it.
Mm.
You can only orientate yourself to it. It's like if I open the window, I can open the blinds, that I can do. But can I force the sun to shine through? No, because it's maybe cloudy.
Well, I kind of chuckle, maybe derisively, when I hear like evangelical Christians say to each other stuff like, my brother in Christ. But actually, when I talk with you, I understand what they mean. So, Joan Evans, my brother in Christ. it's just great to talk with you again. Thank you so much for spending this time with me and with everybody listening. Thank you.
It's a joy. Thank you, Connor.
And thank you, everybody, for listening. Bye now.